Merritt Street, we're building a new morning show where our guiding principle is to always value your time.
We'd love for you to join us. Be part of our community.
Each morning will be packed full of news, information, advice, and a lot of fun.
And we promise we'll never waste your time.
I'm Dominique Soxa.
I'm Fanchon Singer. Join us for Morning on Merritt Street.
8 a.m. Eastern, 7 Central. Essential television.
Why am I choosing to write about this multi-front assault on our society, culture, families, and very way of life? Because I see it. I know where it is headed, and I refuse to choose to accept it. The 10 working principles for a healthy society. How to push back against the social media platforms. How to get your family strong again. You can get it anywhere books are sold on February 27th. The 10 working principles for a healthy society. You're the only you in the history of the world. And I guess with that, I think comes some responsibility to be the best you that you can be. So if you're not really interested in making change, then you don't need to listen to this right now. Come back to it sometime when you do want to make the change, or tell somebody that does want to make a change to listen to it. But if you want to be a better you, then you do want to listen to this. And I can tell you right now, a simple test to determine whether you're ready for change or not, because there are four stages for readiness and change. Four stages for readiness with regard to change. Stage number one is when you're doing it because some authority makes you do it. You get in a fight and you get arrested for disturbing the peace. So you go to court and the court says, well, I'm going to order you into a 12-week anger management program. And you're rolling your eyes and, oh, yeah, fine. Beats paying a fine. So, okay, I'll go. What's the chance that somebody in that circumstance is going to really improve their temper? Probably not very good. They're not motivated. They don't want to be there. They can go in there and sit there and cross their arms, lean back in their chair for their hour, 12 weeks in a row. They fill the square, check the box. They're out of there. They're not motivated to learn. They're not a sponge soaking up information. They're just there because they were ordered to be. Okay, that's stage number one. Stage number two is when you're doing it to please someone else. It's like your spouse wants you to do something. They want you to get more exercise, or they want you to lose weight, or they want you to be less harsh with your family members or something. And so you agree to it, but you're doing it just to make them happy. You don't really think you have a problem, but you agree to it just to make them happy, to get them off of your back. So again, motivation is missing. You're just doing it to please somebody else. Stage three is when your heart's not in it, but at least intellectually, you know that you need to do it. You don't want to do it, but at least intellectually, you know that you need to do it. There's a big difference between wanting to do it and knowing that you need to do it. Maybe you want to, but you don't want to. You wish you did. You wish your heart was in it. And in your head, you know, yeah, it'd probably be better if I did this differently, but I'm just not right now. That's just not on my list of things to do. So in your head, you know it, but in your heart, you're just not really into it. And then there's stage four. Nobody makes lasting change until they're in stage four. Stage four is when you are ready mentally and emotionally to make a change. You are motivated at a heart level to make a change. That's when you look in a mirror and say, I'm not taking this from myself. For another day, for another hour, for another minute will I accept this from myself. I don't care how hard it is. I don't care how scary it is on the other side of the wall. I'm going through the wall. I am so sick of this. I am so sick of myself. I'm so sick of my excuses. I'm so sick of my reality. I don't care what the risks are. I'm making this change. That's when people make changes. That's when people get off of drugs. That's when people lose weight. That's when people change jobs. That's when people stop venting their temper. That's when people get an education instead of continuing in a dead-end job they don't like. That's when people make whatever change it is in stage four of readiness. And you got to ask yourself, am I really ready? Is this a priority to me? Do I approach this with urgency? Am I so sick to death of this? I was talking to a woman not too long ago that said she really, really wanted to lose weight. And I said, yeah, how many diets have you been on in your life? And she said, probably 50. She said, I probably lost 500 pounds, 10 pounds, 50 times. I said, so what's different this time? She said, I am sick to death of it. I'm sick of walking in the room and tugging on my jacket, pulling it down around my hips, pulling it down in the back, pulling it closed in the front. I'm sick to death of walking in a room and trying to get my back against the wall so nobody's looking at me from behind. I'm tired of bending over to try to tie a running shoe, and I'm out of breath because my stomach is pushing up into my lungs and I can't even breathe. I'm sick to death of it. And I said to myself and to her, number 51 just might be your time. You might finally be in stage 4. And I asked her, why should you get to lose weight and somebody else not? She said, I've suffered long enough. I deserve this. I've worked hard and I've failed. I've been criticized. I've hurt. I deserve this. And by God, I'm claiming it. Now, you guys have probably heard me talk about personal truth before. Personal truth is important because what you believe about yourself determines what kind of results you generate in your life. We generate the results in life that we believe we deserve. If we believe that great results, a good job, a healthy body, an athletic figure and build, well-adjusted children, a peaceful marriage, if we believe all of those things are great, but they're for other people, not for me, then you won't have those things. If you believe I'm damaged because I grew up in a chaotic, violent home, and so I'm therefore second class, I'm damaged goods, then you will create that result in your life. You will perpetuate that in your generation because it's what you think you deserve. You generate the results in life you believe you deserve. So you look and you say, what's my background? Who am I? How am I different from other people? And based on that comparison and that judgment you put on yourself, you will generate second-class results because you secretly believe those top-notch results are for other people. Now, you may say different. You say it to other people because you wear a social mask. But if inside you truly believe, yeah, I can talk about it and I can put on an act, but in my quietest moments when I'm alone, I really believe those results are for other people. They're not for me. Then you won't have them. Now, if that's true, how do you change that? Well, if you've got a damaged personal truth, then you have to heal that personal truth. You have to forgive yourself. You have to heal open wounds. And then, this is very important, you have to behave your way to success. Now, some people would say, well, Dr. Phil, that's just a fancy way of saying fake it till you make it. No, it's not, because each behavior you make is authentic. You have to behave your way to success. If you want to be confident, then you need to behave with confidence. You need to act in a confident manner. And you say, well, I'm not really feeling confident, so you're telling me to just act like I am. Well, no, I'm telling you to behave as confident people behave. You say, well, so you're saying fake it. No, I'm saying adapt the behaviors that confident people have. Now, why is that important? Because we make attributions to ourselves about ourselves based on what we observe ourselves do. If we observe ourselves walk into a situation that ordinarily we would be timid and shy and mousy and nervous, but we observe ourselves walk into that situation with our shoulders back, our head held high, and we look people in the eye, shake their hands, and say, hello, good to meet you. I'm glad to be here. That's what a confident person would do, right? They belong there. They believe they belong there. So they act like they belong there. They look people in the eye. They shake their hands. They engage them. They don't apologize for being there. They walk up and say, hello, my name's so-and-so. What's your name? Hi. That's what they do. That's what confident people do. you behave your way to success. You're behaving as confident people behave. So you observe yourself doing that. And then you say, wow, I saw myself do that. So I now see that I can do that. I can be confident in those situations. I have two grandchildren, Avery and London, and they're in lower school. It's interesting that at this school, one of the rules they have is, first off, a teacher or a teacher's aide meets the car every morning when their parents drop them off. They come and open the door, and they say, good morning, Avery, how are you? She cannot look at her shoes and kind of shrink away. She has to say, fine, Mrs. Johnson, how are you? They teach them from very early on how to engage people. They make eye contact. They call them by name. They make an appropriate greeting. And then I've watched these children. They've been there, one for now 4 years, the other for two. I've watched these children when I introduce them to adults in my life. They step up and say, hi, I'm Avery. Hi, I'm London. They've learned to behave in a confident manner. So they've observed themselves do that, and they're confident in meeting people. They behave confidently. They've observed themselves behave confidently. So they are confident. You need to understand that you can behave your way to success. And you don't need to go to a year of therapy to do this. Just listen to what I'm telling you and do it. Save yourself a year of therapy and spend that on wardrobe or a trip. Look, half the solution to any problem lies in properly defining it. And you have to know what you want or you'll never get it. You have to name it to claim it. You have to name it to claim it. You got to know what it is you want in order to recognize it when you get it. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat wherever you are. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. 2 minute meals. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Sign up and save. I love Factor meals, and you will too. All the work is done for you, and it's delicious. It's a no-brainer. Go ahead and try it. So head to factormeals.com/fillintheblanks50 and use code fillintheblanks50 to get 50% off. That's code fillintheblanks50 at factormeals.com/fillintheblanks50 to get 50% off. Field of Greens is the healthiest thing I do every day, and I want you on this journey with me. It's literally one scoop a day, and it's delicious. I like the wild berry flavor. It's completely improved my life. Real, organic, superfood. Field of Greens has real fruit and vegetables. This is nutrition the way nature intended. I have way more energy throughout the day and sleep better at night. I feel healthier, and I know it's doing wonders for my digestion. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you're going to love this product, but if for any reason you don't, they'll give you a 100% money-back guarantee. I got you 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code Dr. Phil. That's promo code Dr. Phil at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Dan Ehrlich, James B. Duke, professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and a founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. He does research in behavioral economics on the irrational ways people behave, described in really plain language. His immersive introduction to irrationality took place as he overcame injuries sustained in an explosion. Now, during a range of treatments in the burn department, he faced a variety of irrational behaviors that were immensely painful, yet persistent. He began researching ways to better deliver painful and unavoidable treatments to patients. Now, Ehrlich became engrossed with the idea that we repeatedly and predictably make the wrong decisions in many aspects of our lives, and that research could help change some of these patterns.
You really get at the heart of this in such creative ways, and I've been excited to talk about this because the rationality and irrationality of decision-making is so outcome determinative in people's everyday lives. It's outcome determinative in what they have for lunch, where they shop, what they buy, but it's also outcome determinative in terms of their lives, what the sum total of their lives are. And I've said to people that follow me many times that since I was 12 years old, I have been fascinated with why people do what they do and don't do what they don't do. And I've always said, if you understand why people do what they do and don't do what they don't do, you have a huge edge in life in terms of managing your own life and getting other people to do the things that you would want to motivate them to do. You really break that down and get to the heart of it. And I believe that most people think they make decisions when in fact they're having decisions made for them by the advertising machine, the marketing machine, people that make forms. And I really want to get into that and talk about it because you've done such a creative job at breaking it down so people understand it. I don't know, maybe people say, why do you do that? Well, it's just because. It's the way it's always been done. I've talked to people who will do something twice and say, that's just the way we've always done it. You've done it twice. What are you talking about? But they default to a comfort zone because they've done something once, twice, three times, and they have no idea why. It's just, that's just the way we've always done it. Why do we accept that?
Yeah. So you've basically kind of captured, I think, the basic lesson of social science. And the basic lesson of social science is that when we make decisions, we think they come from us, but they often they come from the environment. And the thing to understand is that the environment is not really designed to help us make better decisions. So imagine as a metaphor, a person walking down the street. Every coffee shop wants them to buy coffee and a donut. Every app on their phone wants them to spend time on that app right now.
Right.
So we are walking around and other things in our environment want our time, our money, and our attention. And who is there to fight for our long-term wishes? Basically nobody. You know, if you ask the question of who cares about your long-term well-being, maybe it's your significant other. Maybe if you believe in the government, you'll say the government. But the reality is that most of life, we are surrounded by other entities that control the environment and therefore change our decisions. So think about something very simple, like you go to the supermarket and maybe you prepare and you bring a shopping list and that's your plan of action. But the supermarket also has a plan and their plan is different than yours. And right. Guess what? They control the environment. They decide what's at the eye level. They decide what's at the end of the aisle. And because of that, we end up making their decisions more often than we would like. So, and you also mentioned this idea that it's not just about science, it's about our personal lives. And one of my hopes is that we would all become scientists of our own lives, right? We're all the architects of our homes, of our kitchens, of our desks. What are the things that we could do to change the environment to get better outcomes? So the design of the environment is crucially important. And you know, you can even think about refrigerators. So actually, can I ask you a few personal questions?
You bet. Go.
Okay. In the last month, have you eaten more than you think you should?
Every day. I'm totally transparent. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Have you slept less than you think you should?
Every night.
Okay. We can talk about washing hands every time you leave the bathroom. We can talk about taking medications regularly, having safe sex, all of those things. And the reality is that when we look at those, we should all admit that we fail a lot.
Yes.
We fail a lot. And there was this very, very sad study that asked the question of how many people, what percentage of Americans die too early because they've made bad decisions. And the results show that this number is increasing all the time. About 100 years ago, it was less than 10%. Now it's more than 40%.
Wow.
What
because
happened?
Are we becoming dumber? Because of bad decisions.
That's right. And the question is why? Are we becoming dumber? The answer is no. What is happening is that the environment is becoming better at tempting us. Think about donuts. Donuts are really getting better. And what I mean by getting better is not that they're getting healthier, they're getting more tempting.
Right.
Facebook is becoming better. Our phones are becoming better at tempting us. Cigarettes, texting while driving. The reality is that the economy around us is an economy of temptation. And we fail a lot.
Well, one of the things that I've tried to communicate to people across time, and I'd like you to comment on this, I've said that the reason diets fail, for example, is that willpower is a myth, that it's fueled by emotion and emotions are fickle. So January 1st, we make that New Year's resolution. All right, we're going to lose 20 pounds. We're going to get out there and do all of these things. And so we get a new pair of jogging shoes and we put them on the front porch and the damn things just won't jog. You know, you get out there in the middle of February and they're still just sitting there. And I say, look, it's not willpower. You have to program your environment to support your goal. If you don't want to eat too much, if you don't want to eat the wrong foods, then clean up your environment. Set your environment up to support you when you don't feel like doing it. It's easy to do it when you're all pumped up. The hard time to do it is when you aren't emotionally up for it. That's when you need your environment program to support you.
If you woke up every morning 5 miles away from home with your gym shorts and shoes, you'll at least walk home, right? There's no question about it. If you made an appointment to meet a friend to go for a run, you'll show up and go for a run. It's those things that we need to architect. But I'll tell you something we just learned about willpower that I think is incredibly important. So we did a study on a large group of people with diabetes. And we asked the question of what helps, and some people are better managing their diabetes, their A1C, and some people are worse at this. And we asked the question of what differentiates the people who are better at this from the people who are worse at this. And you could say, is it that they understand diabetes? No. Is it that they understand the side effects? No. Is it that they understand how to measure their blood glucose level? No. Is it that they're more motivated? No. Is it willpower? No. The only thing we found is what we call breakpoints. And breakpoint is the point in life where you just fed up. You know, life is tough. You fight with your kids in the morning and try to get them to school, and then somebody tempts you with a cookie, and then your boss says something, and then there's YouTube, and, you know, life kind of, the things accumulate. And sometimes we just fed up. And when we're fed up, what's the easiest, cheapest way to get some happiness? Unhealthy food.
Right.
And we found that that's the cycle of diabetes. And what I think it means is that self-control is not the mechanism for good behavior, as you said, but it is a danger for bad behavior because it's the failure of self-control. And these breakpoints and the time that people are just are miserable and look for quick happiness, those are the things that feed diabetes. And by the way, reaching these breakpoints is faster for people who have diabetes because we all have a busy life and we all have stress. But if you have a regular life plus diabetes, your life is extra stressful. You have to wake up in the morning and measure and run and measure, and you have to eat certain things and don't eat. So the management of life is just much higher. So you're quicker to get to that level of frustration where you want something. So we have to worry about the failures of self-control because this is like, you can diet for a whole week and destroy it in one evening.
Right.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
The first page of a book never tells the full story. And those news alerts and headlines, like the ones we get on our phones, don't even scratch the surface of what the story is really all about. Stories are like people, multi-layered and complex. It takes some digging to find the truth, but when we find it, it can change our world. We like to dig. The news on Merritt Street. Essential television.
You know, what I found in working with people on weight control is that they do most of the damage with a very small group of foods in a very concentrated period of time during their week. They have impulse foods and vulnerable times, and if you can get them away from those foods and give them a competing habit for those vulnerable times, something that they're doing that's incompatible with ingesting these foods during those vulnerable times, that you can really help them sustain themselves. But you've got to recognize when are your vulnerable times and what are your most vulnerable foods. And being a type 2 diabetic, I've learned that across time. But I think what I've had the most fascination with is how you get people to recognize when they're not making these decisions for themselves, when they are being made for them. Advertising, for example. When you look at an ad by McDonald's or some of the fast food franchises that are out there, it's interesting to me how little of the time during the ad they spend showing their food and how much of the time during the ad they're showing acceptance, happiness, togetherness, joy, everybody being included in these restaurants. I've never seen one that looked like the one on television, but everybody in there is happy. They're together. They're selling joy, happiness, togetherness, and the food is almost added on to the end. They want you to feel good about the product, and that sells the product. And I don't think people realize that their emotional strings are being pulled to get them to buy the product. It's not just the meat, cheese, and bread that they're selling.
That's right. And the part of it is that is kind of worrisome is that we imagine that you have two paths to convincing people to do something. One is based on reason and logic, and one is based on emotion. And then you say, which one is the easiest of the two? And it turns out emotion is easier to create.
Right.
So what we do is we take that path and we try to convince people with emotions about everything from, you know, hamburgers to politics, just because it's easier. It's not what you would want people to do, but it's easier to do. And the other thing that you started with is the fact that we don't see it. And that's a fascinating thing, right? So you go to a buffet, and you don't realize how the organization of the food is going to get you to overeat. You look at the refrigerator and you don't understand how that will change what you do. The reality is that for most decisions, we're an autopilot. And then for many other decisions, defaults are incredibly important. So we feel that we make decisions, but the reality is that the choice architecture around us makes many of those decisions for us. But we are so good in telling ourselves stories. We're so good in telling ourselves stories that we tell them so quickly, and then we convince ourselves that we made that decision. So you go to, you go to buy a TV, and they show you three TVs, and they show you a huge one, a large one, and a slightly smaller one, and you choose the middle one. Because that's often what we do, is we choose the compromise. And you don't understand that if they showed you three other televisions, you would choose the middle one as well. But
right.
Once you chose it, you said, this was my choice. We're very, very good at acting based on the environment, but then convincing ourselves that we made the choice ourselves.
Yeah, let's talk about that default. I really want people to understand what you've discovered about this, because you've discovered that when it gets to a complex decision, most people really will, rather than deal with the conflict of complexity, they will default to what they're being structured and funneled into a predetermined decision that the architect wants them to make. Give us some examples of that, if you will.
So I'll give you an example from a study we did with an online pharmacy.
Great.
This online pharmacy, people signed up and they started by buying branded medications, expensive branded medication. Let's say it was $20. It varied, but the average was $20. And they tried to switch people from branded medication to generics. So they wrote people a letter and they said, please, please, please switch to generics. You will save money. We will save money. The world will be a better place. It will only cost you $5 a month. And they sent people those letters and almost nobody switched, less than 3%. So then they said, okay, let's go all out. And they tried something more extreme. And they sent people a letter and they said, currently your medication is $20 and branded. If you switch to generics, it will be free for a whole year. Free for a whole year. Amazing. Free for a whole year. And they expected lots of people to sign up. Only 10% of the people sign up.
Really?
And at that point, they came to my office. And I told them, maybe it's friction. Maybe it's friction. They said, what do you mean? I said, think about what's happening to your customers. They have one option of doing nothing and stay with branded. And they have another option of doing something, move to generic, but it also involves an action. So this is what we call a confounded design. Two things are happening at the same time. It is branded versus generic, but it's also doing something versus doing nothing. I said, which one is it? Is it doing something or doing nothing? Or is it branded versus generic? Right? Do people really love branded? Or do people just really hate returning letters? So the first proposal I told them, I said, let's reverse the default. Let's send people the medication in 3 months and tell them, next time we're switching your medication. Next time you're going to get the generics. No need to worry. You don't need to do anything. You'll get generics. If you want to stay with branded, return the letter. That will be to switch the default, right? You're getting generics next time. So it turns out that's illegal. It's illegal to switch medications like this on people. So what the lawyers allowed us to do was to do what we call a forced choice, is to send people a letter and say, you can choose when you return this letter, branded at $20 or generic at $5. But if you don't return the letter, you will not get your medication, will be forced to stop your delivery. So you see, in the original design, people could do nothing. Now they can't do nothing. They have to do something. And more than 80% of the people switched. So what does it mean? Does it mean that people like generic or branded? It means that people hate returning letters. You know, this whole equation, the real issue was the resistance to returning the letter. Now, it's not because people are stupid or lazy. It's because people are busy. The reality is that with the internet revolution, we all became much, much more busy. Right? There used to be a bank. You went to the bank teller. They did things. You used to go to book a vacation. You went to a travel agent. In half an hour, you had the hotel and a car and a flight. Now we have to do everything ourselves and everything takes longer. And people are incredibly busy and stressed for time. So what happened is that the default is becoming more and more powerful because we're stressed for time. We don't have the energy to deal with anything. It seems like a reasonable suggestion and we just accept it. So that means, you know, that when other people give us offers, we need to think about defaults. But also when we set our own lives, we need to think about what defaults we want to have.
Dr. Phil here. Come February 27th, you're going to be able to pick up a book called We've Got Issues, and you know we do. This is a book that says it's going to teach you how to stand strong for America's soul and sanity. And in this book, I set forth 10 principles for saving this society from going off the deep end. 10 principles for protecting your family, 10 principles for giving you what you need to flourish and have the life that you want for yourself and for your children and for your grandchildren. We've taken some wrong turns. We've been letting the loudest voices dictate some of the thinking that has taken us way off course. Well, I'm speaking up and bringing us back to the center of the road. I hope you'll pick this book up, and I hope you'll read it with a real open mind, because I'm pushing back against a lot of what you've been hearing. Somebody had to do it. Might as well be me. February 27th, we've got issues.
Dr. Dina Mannion is a celebrated doctor of psychology and licensed clinical social worker since 1993, specializing in substance abuse, depression, anxiety, personality disorders, couple counseling, family therapy, and really just a lot of important areas in psychology and human functioning. Is there a point that you believe we should start teaching these kids how to cope with anxiety, depression, stress, cyberbullying, these issues as part of the curriculum in school?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, even though I practice from an eclectic, you know, point of view, I believe that cognitive behavioral therapy is the most researched therapy. It's probably the easiest to understand and to put into practice, because it's very, you know, systematic in terms of how it works. But to change your thinking about something, and not just act on your feeling, but to actually check it, make sure that it's not distorted in some way, hear what some other, you know, possibilities are, and start to really look at, is this just me and my, the way that I feel? Is this something that, you know, like you said, is something that needs to be pursued and dealt with? And I think that we just need to teach our children how to gain skills to cope with adversity, prejudice, bullying, you know, all of these things, being offended, and that it doesn't make it right, but it teaches them how to cope with it, whether that's making the complaint or whether that's dealing with it, you know, onto themselves, or whether it's addressing it or whatever it is. I think to give them some skills other than just call somebody out on social media and try to get them canceled.
I had the opportunity to testify before a bipartisan committee of Congress on the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And it was dealing with, or how to deal with, cyberbullying. One of the things that I heard the administration say is that this is not our job. Our job is to educate these kids at school, because cyberbullying is taking place off campus, not on campus. So that's not our job. That's the job of the parent. I said, you need to make it your job, mm-hmm. because you have access to these kids 40% of their waking hours. Most of these relationships are formed at school, and there was a time when you could leave school and leave the bully behind. The bullying took place on the bus dock. It took place behind the gym. It took place in the cafeteria, and when the student went home, they were safe. Now, the cyber bully can follow them home. And the parent thinks they're back there in their bedroom doing their homework, when in fact they're on some chat group or whatever from school with people saying, we hate you, you're ugly, kill yourself. And too often it has happened that they go back there and find their child, boy or girl, seventh or eighth grade, hanging themselves in their closet, dead. I've had many a story that I've had to do on the show where they've shot themselves or hung themselves. And I'll never forget one mother, not 50 feet from here, her son shot himself in the face
It started with the name calling. Brandon had used a 357 Magnum. When I saw him, the first thought that went through my mind is he looks on the outside now like he has felt on the inside for so long.
These were all kids from school saying terrible things to him on the internet. And I think, again, the schools can help so much if we can teach kids the early warning signs of anxiety, depression, stress, learned helplessness, interpersonal violence. You get these kids in seventh or eighth grade and they get in these relationships and think, oh my God, I'm loved so much because he's calling me 50 times an hour. He's just, they don't realize this is early warning signs of abuse here. You need to spot this and recognize it, and how to deal with a bully, how to defuse a bullying situation, bystander responsibilities when there are bullying situations, how to cope with these things. And it's not going to happen in the schools until you put the money behind it so it becomes part of the curriculum. You got to set aside 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day, 3 days a week, or something like that to teach them the basic tenets of recognizing these red flags and what to do about it when they see it. And cognitive behavioral therapy, to me, seems like a very understandable intervention, short-term intervention strategy that will work with kids at virtually any age.
I agree. I also think that, you know, what you just talked about is so important because it also identifies, you know, if you have it out there in the schools, it identifies for teachers and administrators what the problems are, right? Because so much of this is in secret and without their knowledge. And so kids want to vent. They want to talk about things. And I know when I was a social worker in school, in a school setting, public school, I would have, you know, a lot of kids come to my office and have lunch with me, and we would just sit and chat. And I would find out a lot in that hour lunch period about what was going on. And then, but I was only one person, and I was a social worker at the time and a minority in the school. And, you know, they don't want to hear the problems. You know, they don't really want to hear it. So I think if universally we did this in schools and it was just part of the curriculum, that would be amazing.
Yeah. If they can just teach kids just some of the basic tenets of cognitive behavior therapy, how to reframe their internal dialogue. Don't assume you can read the minds of the person that you're dealing with. Don't assume that you can predict the future. Don't catastrophize. Don't label. Don't discount positives about yourself. Learn to accept compliments from other people. Stop negative filtering. All of these things, and you know, teach them the four criteria for irrational thought so they can test their thinking if they don't have the wherewithal to go talk to somebody. All the different things can make a huge difference.
And we don't know when our thoughts are distorted either.
No, so not unless you test them.
Yeah, exactly.
Get them, if nothing else, to stop playing the what-if game and realize, let's live in the moment and get through. There are so many important things they can teach them. I think if we would start doing some of these things instead of coddling these kids, I think we would have a much better chance of preparing them for life and them succeeding. But that's not going to happen unless you put money and time behind it. And they did some of that in the last reauthorization after we had the hearings, but that was at elementary and secondary level. We'll see how much difference it makes. But now things, the pendulum seems to have swung the other way. So I think I speak for Dean Emanuel as well as myself. We're not here to discount anybody's experience in any way, in anything. There are legitimate traumas, no question about it. We're not saying that. There are triggers that people can walk right into and have a genuine bad response. We're just saying that trigger's gotten to be a hair trigger. And real trauma is being lost in hypersensitivity with so many things that are being labeled as traumatic that really don't qualify as trauma. And if everybody can complain about anything that makes them even moderately uncomfortable, rather than learning to deal with that discomfort so they can take it in stride, they're going to have a rough ride when they get out of college, and college should prepare people to deal with the real world. Dr. Corey Yeager is an MBA psychotherapist and author of a great book called How Am I Doing? 40 Conversations to Have with Yourself. I've read it cover to cover, and I'm going to talk about not all 40 of these conversations because I want you to buy the book and read it. You don't just need to read it, you need to use it, but we're going to talk about that today. Dr. Yeager is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's been focusing his therapeutic practice primarily serving the African American community. But what he has to say, his wisdom cuts across all socioeconomic stratas, all races, colors, creeds, doesn't matter. In your book, How Am I Doing?, you pose 40 questions for people to ask themselves. And I love question number one and question number nine in particular. But question number one, you say, who is the most important person in your life? And most people are going to stop and think and all of that, but your suggested answer to that question, and one I ascribe to wholeheartedly, is it better be you.
Better be.
Because you better take care of yourself or you can't take care of anybody else.
Isn't that simple, though, Doc?
It really, and people think it's selfish to say me. Yeah. It's not selfish. I have two boys and a wife and family members. I can't take care of anybody if I don't take care of myself. If I let myself become emotionally bankrupt, physically bankrupt, or just drop dead from stress, I have to take care of myself so I can take care of others. And that's what you're saying. And I said I like question nine coupled with it because you say, how much time do you spend looking at yourself in the mirror?
Mm-hmm.
You got to look at yourself in the eye and be honest about who you are and what you're doing.
You have to take stock, and the book is really about that, taking stock on not only who I am, but what was the journey that got me to where I am? And then once I can take stock on that, I can seek to understand where I'm headed, where I want to be. On that first question, who's the most important person in your life? To your point, it should easily be answered by I am, but we do see that as being selfish. We see that as being putting myself first, and we're taught almost innately at a young age that we should put all these other people first. Well, if I do that, where do I come in? Do I come seventh on the list, 12th? Coupled with that question nine of the aspects of really kind of once you can get to know yourself, how do you maneuver that and utilize that framework and that understanding in such a way that you draw benefit and those around you draw benefit? I think that kind of, that juxtaposition, Doc, of if I'm taking care of myself, they say it on the airplane, if the cabin pressure gets low, the mask is going to drop. What do they instruct you to do if you're traveling with an infant or a young person? Put yours on first. Well, why would you do that? Because if I have a young child beside me and I'm fumbling and mumbling trying to get theirs on and we both pass out, now we're in trouble. So put your mask on. In life, put your mask on first. Get yourself right. And then you can help that person. Because I believe, Doc, that in life we have a glass. And the job is to fill the glass, fill my glass first. And once my glass is full, everything that is left is for everyone else. They can have it all. but I should first fill my glass, because too often we're running around this world pouring everyone else's glasses full, and we have just a thimble full of water in ours. So I'm asking people to fill their glasses.
Yeah, that's the only sustainable model. And I hate that we've taught people that it's selfish for self-preservation. And I really try and teach people to test their thoughts for their rationality. I try to say there are just four simple things. I'd love for young men to write this down on a card or put it in their phone or whatever and keep it handy. When you have a thought, ask yourself, first off, is it based in fact? Because we tell ourselves things all the time, and they're based on feelings. I have people tell me all the time, and somebody tell me today, well, I feel like, and I wasn't trying to be rude, but I said, I don't care how you feel. I barely care how I feel.
Yes.
what I care is what is.
Yes.
It's kind of like people saying, I'm going to go to the store and get what we need. I was, well, no, wait a minute. There's what you want, there's what you need, and then there's what you can afford.
Yes.
It really doesn't matter if you need a coat. What matters is, can you afford to get a coat?
Yeah.
When you grow up poor, that's you learn the difference between what you need and what you can afford. We've got to get people to start dealing with the facts again.
Yes.
And people don't deal with the facts enough.
Well, and I think one of the struggles as well, Doc, is what we'll do is we'll tell ourselves a number of untruths. And if you tell yourself this untruth long enough, it becomes a reality for you. So how can we check ourselves about those untruths that we're lying to ourselves about? So one way, and I talk about in the book, and you referenced it, getting in the mirror of your life.
Yeah.
Taking the time. And I think we avoid the mirror, Doctor, because the man or woman that peers back at us in the mirror knows all. Knows every aspect of us, that I can BS you and everyone around. But when I look at that man in the mirror, he knows all.
Well, that's your question number three. Who knows you best?
Mm-hmm.
You do if you're telling yourself the truth.
If
I interrupted myself and said, I give them four questions you need to ask. Number one, is this true? Is it based on fact? Number two, is it in my best interest? Number three, does it get me what I want and need? And number four, does it protect and prolong my life?
Mm.
That's all you need.
Ooh.
If you're telling yourself something, test what you're saying with those four things. If it fails any of the four, you got to kick it out and create something that fits all four. Is it based in fact? Does it get me what I want and need? Does it protect and prolong my life? Those are the things you need to be looking at.
A game changer for me that I heard you say many years ago, and I use it daily, is that what we do in life is we teach others how to treat us.
No, isn't it the truth?
Right? I mean, good, bad, or indifferent, we teach people how to treat us. So this is where it could be conflated and we can start to play around, is this selfish or... But I'm going to teach people where the boundaries are with me. My wife knows I get busy, and if I feel like I'm starting to move to a space of being overwhelmed, I'll tell her, and she now understands it deeply, that I need Corey time before I can be a good husband, before I can be a good pops, before I can be a good coach or a therapist. I must first be a good Corey for Corey. And once I can do that and feel strongly and in place with that, I can do a lot of things. I can, I can be supportive of a lot of ventures and opportunities, but I must first be a good friend, brother, to Corey, to myself. And I'm working on that every single day. I wake up every morning and literally get in the mirror and smile at myself. I'm not waiting for someone else to smile at me, Doc.
Yeah.
I'll do it first.
Yeah. My dad passed away when he was 72. By that time, and I'm not saying I was the best kid in the history of the world, but by the time he had passed away, I'd done okay. I'd gotten a bachelor's, master's, PhD, and postdoctoral fellowship in forensic psychology. I'd gotten married, had a nice family, was, I think, pretty responsible contributing member of society, had gone to school on a football scholarship and done a lot of things that you think would be reasonable. And I had known him for 42 years, and not one time in my life did he ever say, I'm proud of you.
Mm.
Never. I never heard those words come out of his mouth. Mm-hmm. So you can say, well, he was a bad alcoholic, so he had a lot of issues for most of his life. So you can decide, well, I've got to damage personal truth, or you can decide, sometimes I've got to give myself what I wish I could get from somebody mm-hmm. else. And that's why I like question number 9, mm-hmm. because sometimes you look and take stock, and sometimes you need to look at yourself in the mirror and give yourself what you wish you get from somebody else. You got to look yes. in the mirror and say, hey, I'm proud of myself as a right. father. I'm proud of myself as a husband. I'm proud of myself as a contributing member of society. And yes. if you don't get it where you wish you get it, you got to give it to yourself till you get it from somewhere else.
And you say, Doc, you use a couple of words, decide and choice. That life is filled with a series of decisions and choices. And my mom, when I had about 30 Division I football offers coming out of junior college, and I chose Long Beach State because a good friend of mine lived out here and was going to play at USC. My sister was living in the Norwalk, Long Beach area, so I decided Long Beach State. And I got here, coming from a little small farming rural community in Kansas, I got here to Long Beach, and boy, there was diversity to the nth degree. And I wasn't comfortable. It was new territory. I wasn't comfortable. 2 weeks go by. I call my mom. I don't know if this is the best fit for me, Mom. Can you get a hold of, at this point, I think it was Coach Snyder's second year at Kansas State. Can you call Coach Snyder and ask him if that full scholarship is still available? I think coming back to Kansas may be what I need. She gave me the best advice that anyone has ever given, and it found its way into the book. She said, you made that choice. Now go about making that choice the right one. So too often we leave to chance and we fret about making the perfect decision, the perfect choice. And there is no such thing. But what we can do is go through our process to make the final call on what the decision is. And every day, go about making that choice the right one, outworking everyone around you, taking joy and pride in your work every single day. And if we do that consistently, we'll make the choice right by our hard work and preparation. I think it's simple, and I say this a lot, Doc. I think many of these ideas are very simple. That doesn't mean they're easy, but relatively speaking, they're pretty simple. So how do we do that? How do we make sure that we're leaning into that process in a way that is beneficial, not once again to us individually, but to our social networks and those around us that mean a lot to us?
Well, that's where you learn something about yourself, right? I can't tell you that I'll always make the right decision, but I can tell you that I'll always work to make the decision right.
Whoa, boy. Come on now.
That's what I do know about myself. I may not make the right decision, but I know I'll work my butt off to make the decision right. That's from commitment and hanging in there and, you know, getting up early, staying up late, yep. staying focused. And sometimes I probably haven't made the right decision, but by working hard, mm-hmm. I made it right. And
that's right.
Maybe it'd have been an easier road somewhere else. I don't know, because I never switched and went to the other road. That's you didn't go back to you didn't go back to Kansas State. No.
That's that grit and that grind, though. Yeah. Every day, if I hit the floor and I say I'm going to dedicate to grinding forward and move with a level of grit and perseverance that will be unmatched, I'll be okay.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.